The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from the August 31st, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the inside of a large Catholic cathedral. It looks like there's a cardinal standing. He's in his red robe with a red cap, has his head bent down. There's a stained glass window behind him and the light shining through it. And the title is Shamed Again. How should the Catholic Church respond to yet another sex abuse scandal? And that is our main story, but I'm going to start with the editor's letter that also deals with it. Decades after I graduated from a Catholic all-boys high school in Brooklyn, I received a letter notifying me that Brother Kieran Powers, the principal during my years, had been accused of molesting students. Online, I found several posts by students expanding on Powers' predations. The things he did to me and other students were horrendous, one wrote. I'm sure he is burning in hell. Powers had escaped earthly justice in the unlikely event there was to be any, by dying. During my high school years, I had no inkling of any abuses, but even to my adolescent eye, many of the celibate Xaverian brothers who ran the place seemed either vaguely unhappy or openly angry about their constricted lives. A few had obvious drinking problems. Several quit the order. Before class one day, one brother flew into a spittle-flecked rage when he saw a group of grinning boys looking out the window at a pretty girl. "What are you, animals?" he shouted, and stormed from the room. As Catholics struggle to save their church from the clergy, the issue of celibacy can no longer be ignored. The celibacy requirement imposed in 1139 AD has drawn men into the priesthood who are seeking to flee their sexual attractions. It twists the normal human need for touch and intimacy into something dark, furtive, and predatory. When no form of sex is allowed, said Andrew Sullivan this week in nymag.com, all forms of sex can seem equally immoral. That moral confusion among priests has created tens of thousands of victims around the world whose faith brought them lifelong emotional wounds. Enough, surely, is enough. If the church is to reclaim its lost moral authority, it will have to tear down its secretive all-male hierarchy. If the church is to be saved, it will let priests marry, and it will welcome women into the priesthood and the Vatican. The alternative is increasing irrelevance. And that was from William Falk, the editor-in-chief of The Week magazine. So the main stories and how they were covered. Report reveals horrifying abuses by Catholic priests. What happened? The Catholic Church has been rocked to its foundations by a Pennsylvania grand jury report that provides horrifying details of seven decades of sexual abuse committed by more than 300 priests who were systematically protected by church leaders. More than 1,000 child victims were identified during an 18-month investigation launched by the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office. The most sweeping examination yet of the American Catholic Church's handling of sex crimes. The report describes many of the alleged abuses in shocking detail. One priest forced a 9-year-old to perform oral sex on him, then rinsed out the boy's mouth with holy water to purify him. Another was allowed to stay in the ministry after raping a 17-year-old girl and arranging for an abortion. In Pittsburgh, a group of priests used whips, violence, and sadism in sexually assaulting children, gave their victims special gold crosses to mark them as having been groomed for abuse, and created a child pornography ring. priests were raping little boys and girls, the report says, and the men of God who were responsible for them not only did nothing, they hid it all. The grand jury heard testimony from dozens of witnesses and examined more than 500,000 internal church documents that Catholic officials referred to as the secret archives, which detailed strategies for keeping the information from getting out. The church constructed a playbook for concealing the truth, the grand jury wrote. Tactics included using euphemisms like boundary issue to describe assaults, lying to parishioners about why accused priests had been reassigned to new dioceses, and leaning on local officials to stop investigations. In an unprecedented open letter to the world's 1.2 billion Catholics, Pope Francis this week condemned clerical atrocities and said no effort must be spared to prevent future abuses and cover-ups. These wounds never go away, Francis wrote. We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them, what the editorial said. The Pope's words aren't enough, said the Boston Globe. The rot in the Catholic Church runs deep. The Pennsylvania report comes just weeks after the resignation of Cardinal Theodore E. McCarrick, the former Archbishop of Washington, who has been accused of sexually abusing children and seminarians. Abuse scandals have also rocked the church in Australia and Chile this year, and have occurred in a series of waves since the 1990s in the U.S., Europe, Latin America, and Australia. Pope Francis needs to act, and he needs to act now. Civil authorities need to take action as well, said the Washington Post. Victims often cannot speak for decades about the abuse they suffered as children, but the Catholic Church has spent millions of dollars lobbying against laws extending the statute of limitations for criminal charges and lawsuits involving child sexual abuse. In Pennsylvania, child victims can file lawsuits only until age 30, meaning that none of the priests accused in the grand jury report can ever be held accountable. Lawmakers should tear down the protections for pedophile priests. Well, the columnist said, if the priests described in the grand jury report were, say, Muslim immigrants, said me Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com, we would be asking tough questions about the culture that produces abuse on this scale. We'd be asking, what twisted form of political correctness kept law enforcement from targeting this criminal network sooner? We might even debate closing our borders to people from countries where the gang operates. At the very least, other states should follow Pennsylvania's lead with their own investigations. If the church cannot govern itself from within, then it will be governed from without. The church's perverse attitude towards sex has to change, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. When no form of sex is allowed, all forms of sex seem equally immoral. That's how you end up with priests reportedly whipping victims with leather straps and forcing naked young boys to pose like Jesus on the cross. We have long discovered that secretive, hierarchical cabals of single men are usually trouble in any context. Ending the celibacy requirement and allowing women and married men into the priesthood is a no-brainer. That's a mistaken conclusion, said John Daniel Davidson in TheFederalist.com. This is not a crisis of Catholic teaching or tradition. It's a crisis caused by a faction of liberal priests and bishops who embraced the sexual revolution and lost sight of their sacred duties. Catholics need to cast out the wolves who have stolen in among Christ's flock. Nothing can amount to penitence that is deserved, said Elizabeth Brunig in the Washington Post. Catholic lay people should demand that church authorities cooperate fully with local law enforcement, having proven incompetent to address this crisis themselves. There should also be mass defrockings, but the nature of these crimes was so horrifying that the church cannot hope to recover the confidence of Catholics. Evil is real, and it walked the earth in Pennsylvania. It entered through our church's doors. Thank you. The controversy of the week is titled Security Clearances, the Battle Between Trump and Brennan. Another week of the Trump presidency, another step closer to the abyss, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. President Trump's latest lurch toward authoritarianism came last week when he revoked the security clearance of former CIA chief John Brennan. The White House essentially admitted that the revocation was payback for Brennan's harsh public criticism of Trump or erratic conduct and behavior, as Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders put it. The president's attempt to punish Brennan prompted retired Navy Admiral William McRaven, who oversaw the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, to write a letter asking for his own clearance to be revoked, so I can add my name to the list of men and women who have spoken up against your presidency. Nearly 200 other intelligence officials have now joined that list, accusing Trump of trying to stifle free speech. These usually tight-lipped intelligence professionals are speaking up because they know the stakes, said Jeffrey Smith in NYTimes.com. They know that dictators use state power to punish and intimidate critics, and that fear is no way to run a democracy. Brennan is no hero, said Peter Van Buren in the AmericanConservative.com, and he deserved to lose his clearance. The only reason intelligence officials get to keep their security clearance is so they can give informed advice to officials currently serving. Brennan, conversely, has been using his status as former CIA director in a blatantly partisan anti-Trump campaign, calling Trump treasonous and hinting to the public that he knows the whole story of Russian collusion. When pressed, he admits he only knows what he reads in the newspapers. Brennan isn't merely engaging in free speech criticism of Trump's public statements and actions, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. He keeps hinting that there are shoes yet to drop, information that he knows about as an intelligence agency insider. For Trump to yank the clearance Brennan abused so grotesquely is not only warranted, it is way overdue. Trump's real target isn't Brennan, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. It's special counsel Robert Mueller. As Trump explained in a Wall Street Journal interview, he revoked Brennan's clearance because of his role in launching the rigged witch hunt, that is, the Russia investigation. Terrified of what Mueller will find, Trump is working round the clock to discredit anyone and everyone associated with the probe, hoping he can convince Republicans that Mueller's eventual report is the tainted product of a deep state coup. Brennan is just the beginning, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Trump has drawn up a Nixon-style enemies list of current and former Justice Department and intelligence officials with connections to the Russia investigation, whose security clearances he plans to revoke. A clear and unacceptable abuse of power. Trump has a good political reason to pick this fight, said Jack Goldsmith in LawfareBlog.com. In taking Trump on, Brennan and his allies are playing right into the president's hands. What better evidence of deep state conspiracy could Trump hope to offer his supporters than to have hundreds of unelected government officials opposing him in unison? Trump doesn't want to silence Brennan, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com. He wants to elevate him, turning an irascible Obama-era CIA director into the face of the so-called resistance. Trump hopes not only to frame the Russia investigation in partisan terms, he plans to set himself up to run for re-election in 2020 as an embattled outsider. And our good week, bad week segment this week, we have that it was a good week for appeasement with the unveiling of new public urinals on the streets of Paris. to cut down on drunken men peeing in the street. The new waist-high bright red urinals offer little privacy but are designed for civilizing wild peeing. It was a good week for postmodernism after Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal attorney, declared in an interview that, quote, truth is not truth. Giuliani explained that if Trump's version of events differs from that of other witnesses in the Russia investigation, it's not possible to determine which is true, so there's no need for his testimony. And it was a good week for bribery. After two beer truck drivers in St. Paul, Minnesota, managed to talk a suicidal man off the edge of a bridge by offering him a 12-pack of Coors Light. Beer has been bringing people together for a long, long time, said a spokesman for local police. But it was a bad week for the term Mormons after the new leader of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced church members should no longer be referred to by that popular term. Latter-day Saints is now preferred. It was a bad week for stereotyping after an 18-year-old Afghan refugee was denied asylum in Austria because he didn't seem gay enough to be a victim of persecution. Neither your gait, your behavior, or your clothing have even hinted that you could be homosexual, officials said. And finally, it was a bad week for reality. After a visitor to a Portuguese art museum fell into Anish Kapoor's Descent into Limbo, an 8-foot-deep hole painted with high-tech, light-repelling paint so as to appear like a black circle on solid ground. The surprised and bruised visitor is recovering. On the briefing page now, titled this week, The Right's Judicial Pipeline. The Federalist Society built a national farm system for conservative judges that has changed the nation. What is the Federalist Society? It's an organization of more than 70,000 conservative and libertarian lawyers and law students with chapters at every accredited law school in the country. All of the Supreme Court conservative justices, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Chief Justice John Roberts, have been members, as has Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace retired Justice Anthony Kennedy. That's no coincidence. The Federalist Society exerts unparalleled influence over Republican judicial appointments, offering the definitive endorsement of a potential judge's conservative bona fides. Its members place a premium on individual liberty, traditional values, and the rule of law, the society states. In practice, that translates to fewer restrictions on gun ownership and campaign donations, and opposition to legal abortion, government regulation of private industry, and race-based affirmative action policies that defy a colorblind constitution. During his campaign for president, Trump promised that all of his judicial appointees would be picked by the Federalist Society. How did the society start? When Ronald Reagan led the conservative revolution that put him in the White House in 1981, law schools were dominated by liberal professors. A small group of conservative students at Yale and the University of Chicago banded together to challenge that status quo. The Yale students were led by Professor Robert Bork, whom Reagan later nominated to the Supreme Court. He was rejected by the Senate Democrats as too extreme. The Chicago students were mentored by Antonin Scalia, whom Reagan successfully placed on the court in 1986. Scalia and Bork were the leading proponents of originalism, which holds that judges should interpret the Constitution by attempting to discern the literal meaning of the text when it was written. If the framers, the Federalists, didn't specify a right to abortion or to privacy, for example, then these rights have no constitutional basis. Liberal justices, by contrast, perceive the Constitution as a living document whose descriptions of basic rights can be interpreted in a more expansive way, tailored to modern circumstances. Speaking at the Society's 25th anniversary, Scalia said, "We thought we were just planting a wildflower among the weeds of academic liberalism, and it turned out to be an oak." Why was the Society so successful? For decades, judges appointed by Republican presidents tended to drift to the left over the course of their careers. For example, one of George H.W. Bush's picks for the highest court, David Souter, ended up reliably siding with the liberal bloc, voting in 1992 in Planned Parenthood versus Casey to uphold the right to abortion established in Roe versus Wade. Originalism was created in part to guard against such betrayals by emphasizing a fixed interpretation of the law. After George W. Bush was elected president, conservatives loudly objected to his nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court on the grounds that Myers, not a Federalist Society member, might drift to the middle, like Reagan appointee she was tapped to replace, Sandra Day O'Connor. Bush's second choice, Alito, was an active member of the Society and has been one of the court's most consistent conservative votes. How does the Society work? The organization claims to be nonpartisan, Society of Ideas, but that it shares objectives with the Republican Party is undeniable. It receives millions of dollars from conservative and libertarian mega donors, such as the Mercer family and the Koch brothers. The Society reported $28 million in assets in 2017. To help seed the system with conservatives, judges who belong to the Federalist Society give prestigious clerkships to fellow members, who then have a better shot at one day becoming judges themselves. You have to have that army before you can credential them, said Kurt Levy, whose Committee for Justice is closely allied with the Federalist Society. Is Trump on board? More than any president before him, back in early 2016, then-candidate Trump was still struggling to convince Republican voters that he would nominate a conservative thoroughbred to replace Scalia, who had just died. His top campaign lawyer and eventual White House counsel, Donald McGahn, asked Leonard Leo, executive vice president of the Federalist Society, for suggestions. All but one of the names on Trump's list of 25 candidates were Society members, including Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Trump's decision to release that list won over social conservatives, said Republican strategist Scott Reed. It was a brilliant strategy, he said, and it worked. Are the Federalists winning? During the Obama years, conservatives lost major battles on gay marriage and the Affordable Care Act. But if Kennedy is replaced by Kavanaugh or another justice with Federalist views, the court will move significantly to the right for years to come. Trump also inherited more than 100 openings in the federal judiciary, mainly because the Republican-controlled Senate systematically blocked President Obama's appointments. Trump's tenure in office, Leo says, presents an opportunity for transformation of the federal bench. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. The first comes from the U.S. David Glasser at Politico.com writes, Stephen Miller, immigration hypocrite. Stephen Miller is a total hypocrite on immigration, said David Glasser. I know because I'm his uncle. As a senior advisor to President Trump, my nephew is the architect of exclusionary immigration policies such as the Muslim travel ban, the radical decrease in accepted refugees, separating children from their parents, and the attempt to ban chain migration. These mean-spirited policies are a denial of his own family's story. In 1903, my grandfather fled anti-Jewish pogroms in Russia, arriving at Ellis Island with $8 to his name and no understanding of English. Through street corner peddling and sweatshop toil, our patriarch worked to buy his relatives passage to America through chain migration. Like today's Hispanic immigrants, our family was not always welcomed, with hate mongers condemning Jews and other new arrivals as scum, rapists, gangsters, drunks, and terrorists. But thanks to the miracle of America, the Glosser family had the freedom to work hard and create good lives for their children. Trump, too, is the descendant of immigrants who brought their families here through chain migration. How can these descendants of yesterday's immigrants portray today's desperate migrants as ghoulish caricatures? My nephew has shamed our ancestors and our country. This is from Sweden. Far-right party is a stooge of Russia. Is Sweden about to vote itself over to Kremlin control? Asks Anders Lindberg. The far-right Sweden Democrats Party, which has neo-Nazi and white nationalist roots, is tipped to win more legislative seats than any other in the September 9th election, and it's long past time for Swedes to probe the party's Russian ties. The SD has consistently backed the Russian line on the annexation of Crimea, for example, and its members express open admiration for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Concerns began to be raised 4 years ago when the SD appointed a lawmaker linked with Russian ultranationalists to the State Air Defense Committee, giving him access to sensitive information. Then in 2016, the SD hired a Russian-born Swede as a parliamentary aide. He turned out to have financial ties to a Kremlin-linked Russian businessman. All the warning bells were ringing, said Lars Nikander, chief investigator at the Swedish Defense Academy. Having a possible double agent roaming the halls of parliament was an extraordinary breach. He could have overheard confidential conversations about NATO or the Nord Stream gas deal with Russia, or even installed listening devices in the Riksdag. We can't be sure that the SD is working for Sweden's interests, and that is terrifying. This comes from Australia. Going the wrong way on energy. Australia is getting hammered by climate change, said Bob Brown, former head of the Green Party, and the government's new energy plan won't help. The National Energy Guarantee Policy is supposed to provide reliable power with a mix of energy sources that can be fired up as needed. To get there, though, the government is abandoning Australia's commitments under the Paris Agreement on climate change. It has slashed subsidies for green energy sources, including solar and wind power, even as it considers allowing Indian billionaire industrialist Gautam Adani to dig the world's biggest export coal mine, which would produce annual greenhouse gas emissions greater than those of medium-sized countries like Malaysia. Environment Minister Josh Frydenberg says that the energy plan will save consumers $500 a year each. Yet that doesn't take into account the price of the Great Barrier Reef being half dead and of death-dealing heat waves in our cities. Rising sea levels are damaging our coastal infrastructure, and rising temperatures are drying out the Murray-Darling Basin, where most of our food is grown. These costs will hit everyone's pocket, from rising insurance premiums to the direct impacts on households, business, and government. The new policy fails to mitigate global warming, or even lower power bills. Instead, it offers handouts to the fossil fuel industry. the last word feature, our in-depth article is titled Life with Kellyanne and George. She's a Trump loyalist. He thinks Trump is a threat to democracy. Journalist Ben Terrest asks the Conways the question that has consumed Washington gossip. What's up with that? Kellyanne Conway is in her living room showing me an enormous painting of Audrey Hepburn wearing a peacock on her head. But her husband George really wants us to come into his office and look at a photograph of the moment everything changed. It's a picture he took on election night 2016. Donald Trump is reaching for the first draft of his acceptance speech just as victory seems imminent. Back then, George was such an ardent supporter of the president and so proud of his wife for her historic role as campaign manager that he wept for joy. That photo was from before you cried, Kellyanne says. Now I cry for other reasons, George mutters. Kellyanne pretends to ignore that comment, something she's been doing a lot of lately. You gotta see this picture, George, 54 says. You should like this. It's your boss. He's not just my boss, Kellyanne, 51 says. He's our president. Yeah, George says, walking out of the room. We'll see how long that lasts. Here at the Conways, it's a house divided. She is Trump's loyal advisor, the woman who carried him over the finish line to the White House. He is one of the president's most notable conservative critics and wishes he had never introduced his wife to Trump in the first place. And their feud, thanks to George's newfound Twitter hobby, is playing out for more than just the neighbors to see. When the president was in search of a new communications director last year, George tweeted it was absurd that the president so often says one thing and then does the opposite. In addition to various tweets about corgis and the Philadelphia Eagles, he has retweeted dozens of articles critical of the president and his administration, and he penned a 3,473-word essay rebutting Trump's assertion that Special Counselor Robert Mueller III's Russia investigation was unconstitutional. Because George is married to Kellyanne, the chief architect and top saleswoman for Trumpism, and because his dissent seemed to come out of nowhere, George went viral. His retweets were themselves retweeted and topped with bug-eyed emoji. His follower count soared to more than 90,000, and the left adopted this conservative super lawyer as an honorary member of the resistance. And yet, anyone wondering how Kellyanne and George managed to live in the same place these days should really see the house. The $7.7 million Mediterranean revivalist, with its terracotta roof and three-story turret, looks like a mini Mar-a-Lago. Clocking in at 15,000 square feet, it gives the Conways room for their four children, two corgis, and art collection, with plenty of space left over for the kind of dinner parties typical in this Tony neighborhood off Embassy Row. Inside, Kellyanne, who is shorter than she appears on television, scrambles up the staircase barefoot to put on workout clothes. George, a stocky man with a mop of dark hair, he looks Hawaiian, as Kellyanne puts it, retires to his office. George, we're going for a walk, Kellyanne, now wearing sneakers and her hair in a ponytail, shouts. George never comes on these walks. In fairness to George, Kellyanne is difficult to keep up with. We're in the woods, chugging up a steep incline. We're in Georgetown, going on and off the sidewalk and on and off the record. We're in Tenleytown, weaving through the sideways glances of looky-loos, then power walking through Glover Park. It's a swampy August night, but Kellyanne doesn't have a drop of sweat on her. And she talks about any and everything. Issues with her father. He left when she was three. Feminists. The funny thing, she says, is she's living the life they claim to want. And her thoughts on the administration's practice since reversed of having federal agents separate migrant families at the border. She didn't like it, she says, but that wasn't the president's fault. If you make this story all about him, I'll definitely push back on that after it's printed, Kellyanne says, talking about George. There's no story about me except that overcoming of circumstance and the fact that I'm so independent. Kellyanne remembers how encouraging George was of that independence when they first got married 17 years ago. Back then, Kellyanne was just finding her footing as a sought-after pollster in Washington. She remembers one of George's friends telling him that the best thing for their marriage would be for her to shut down her business, the company she built from scratch, and how George, even though he made enough money himself to support the family, encouraged her to keep working toward her own dream. And now, I feel there's a part of him that thinks I chose Donald Trump over him, Kellyanne says as we walk, which is ridiculous. One is my work and one is my marriage. Naturally, though, the two things overlap. When George criticizes the president publicly, Kellyanne says, the media coverage and the implication that they are pitted against each other bothers their children. And as for the president himself, Kellyanne won't say it irks him, but she does think he finds it impolite. On that, she'd agree. I think it's disrespectful, she says. I think it disrespects his wife. Kellyanne is an independent woman, stuck between two men who could blow up her day with a tweet. Nobody knows who I am because of my husband, she says. People know of my husband because of me. After our six-mile journey, it is late when we get back to their house. George is in his office eating a bowl of cereal and yawning. He's too tired for an interview at the moment, he says. He's never done an interview on his thoughts on Trump, preferring to let the tweets speak for himself. 2 hours after I leave, he's awake and online. A tweet from Merriam-Webster has caught his eye, and he presses the retweet button. Merriam-Webster, mendacious, adjective, likely to tell lies. Mendacity, noun, a lack of honesty or a lie. There's a theory among D.C. Trumpologists that this is all a charade, a way for the Conways to be part of both the Trump White House and the Trump-Leary establishment. They live in a part of the city where wealth and influence serve as a cooling balm for the partisan inflammation that has spread elsewhere. In their neighborhood, everybody, Democrat and Republican, belongs to the Garden Party. Here, a husband subtweeting his wife's boss may seem less an act of moral courage than a juicy gossip item, or possibly a way for the family to hedge its bets. It's 3 days after the house tour, and we're in Ventnor City, New Jersey, just a boardwalk away from Atlantic City, at George and Kellyanne's beach house. Kellyanne bought this house back in the late 90s when she was single and just started making good money. She picked this spot because it felt like home. Her mother had been employed at a casino nearby for more than 20 years and still lives in the house where she raised Kellyanne less than an hour away. The beach house also happens to be right down the road from Trump's old Taj Mahal Resort and Casino. It was wildly popular, says Kellyanne. It went bankrupt twice, says George. George isn't from around here. He grew up in Massachusetts. A contrarian sense. As a child, he decided to root for the Yankees instead of the Red Sox. By the time he was 30, he was a hotshot lawyer, a partner at a big-time law firm in New York City. While there, George fell into a clutch of Republicans secretly working behind the scenes to lay the groundwork for Bill Clinton's impeachment. It wasn't his day job, just a hobby, but one that got him a lot of attention. One of his friends from that time, Ann Coulter, introduced him to Kellyanne. George would, in turn, introduce Kellyanne to Donald Trump. Shortly after getting married in 2001, Kellyanne and George moved into an apartment in Manhattan's Trump World Tower. There, George made an impression on the future president at a condo board meeting, where he argued against removing Trump's name from the building. The speech earned George an offer to join the condo board, which he declined but passed on to his wife, who accepted. Knowing what I know now, George told me later back in Washington, I would have said no and never mentioned it when I got home. Nevertheless, George liked Trump well enough for a time that he considered joining his administration with a top role in the Justice Department. But his pre-nomination process coincided with Trump firing FBI Director James Comey and the beginning of the Mueller investigation. Instead, George immersed himself in the small fraternity of anti-Trump conservatives. He is now a man without a party. In early May of this year, George changed his affiliation from Republican to unaffiliated. He has, according to Politico.com, offered unsolicited advice to journalists who have written articles critical of the president. And recently, he has been spotted at a semi-secret group of Trump skeptics known as the Meeting of the Concerned, eviscerating his wife's boss among fellow conservatives who would like to see Trump, and by extension Kellyanne, out of a job. If he's being honest, that would make George happy too. If my wife were the counselor to the CEO of Pepsi and I had a problem with her boss, I would simply drink my Coke and keep my mouth shut, he says. If the president were simply mediocre or even bad, I'd have nothing to say. This is much different. George is clearly worried about Kellyanne and her reputation, just as Kellyanne told me she is worried about George's. But that doesn't mean everything has changed. He's still proud of what she's been able to accomplish, he says. And when he looks at that picture from election night, he's still reminded of the sheer elation he felt. I'm just saddened by how things turned out, he says. On their last full day together at the beach, George is in the kitchen with his wife by his side. Tomorrow the house will be set up for Face the Nation, after which Kellyanne will be swarmed on the street by fans while George watches the second half of the show, the part where pundits analyze his wife's interview, alone in the kitchen. But for now, things feel almost like they used to be. This is what George misses at times, his simpler life. He starts to open up about his tweets. Kellyanne is cutting vegetables 10 feet away with a longtime friend. The women start singing The Glory of Love, a central song in the weepy movie Beaches, which also took place on the Jersey Shore and is about two childhood best friends. It's an outlet that keeps it a small part of my life, George says of his tweeting. You've got to win a little, lose a little, and always have the blues a little. It's a quick, easy way to express myself that keeps me from making it a bigger part of my life, he says. You've got to give a little, take a little, and let your poor heart break a little. I think I'm actually holding back a little, he says. I think the reason why is obvious. Kellyanne is now singing loudly into a cucumber, completely drowning out George, who has stopped talking and just looks on. That's the story of That's the Glory of Love. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And one of the obituaries this week for a very popular lady, the soul singer who demanded our attention, Aretha Franklin, 1942 to 2018. Before Aretha Franklin flipped the script with her 1967 recording, Otis Redding's Respect was a song about a man pleading for some deference in his home. After Franklin sang it, adding the unforgettable bridge, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what that means to me, deference was the last thing it made anyone think of. Franklin never got a penny from the 7 million times her version of Respect was played on the radio. All the royalties went to Redding and his record label. But as with every song the Queen of Soul performed, Franklin's interpretation became the one we remember. When Aretha sang it, recalled one musician who played with her, that's the way it was sung by everybody else. Respect became an anthem for the emerging woman's movement and the ascendant civil rights movement. Franklin gave it gospel euphoria, rhythm, and blues sensuality, and the relentlessness of rock and roll, and all the pain of her own turbulent life. If a song's about something I've experienced or that could have happened to me, it's good, Franklin says, because that's what soul is about, just living and having to get along. Born in Memphis and raised in Detroit, Franklin had a childhood filled with music, said the New York Times. Her father, C.L. Franklin, a prominent Baptist minister whose sermons were broadcast nationwide, hosted visiting musicians like Dinah Washington, Mahalia Jackson, and Sam Cooke. At 12, Franklin joined her father on tour, singing gospel standards and playing piano for crowds who flocked to hear her father preach. By 14, she had released her first album. Her father was also noted as a playboy, the Washington Post said, and his church mixed religious revival with so much sexual intensity that it managed to shock the far from inexperienced soul artist Ray Charles. By the time she turned 15, Franklin was already the mother of two sons from two different fathers. She left home to go to New York, and at age 18, she signed with Columbia Records, where famed producer John Hammond believed he had found the greatest voice since Billie Holiday. Franklin recorded a string of uneven records until everything changed in 1967 with I Never Loved a Man. And Rolling Stone, starting in 1968, she won 8 consecutive Grammys for her R&B performances. Her songs combined calls for political liberation with romantic torment, with all the soaring power of her preacher's daughter roots. It's Aretha conducting church right in the middle of a smoky nightclub, producer Jerry Wexler said, of one of her gospel pop classics, Spirit in the Dark. Through all the years of her peak performances, Franklin's personal life was marked by struggle. Time magazine noted in 1968 that her first husband, Ted White, roughed her up in public. They divorced in 1969, but her voice never let her down. In the early 1970s, one incandescent song followed another, said Variety. She borrowed promiscuously, fusing gospel with mainstream hits of the time, reimagining Bridge Over Troubled Water, and singing for the counterculture at San Francisco's Fillmore West. The disco era of the late 1970s brought new challenges as Franklin's star power waned, and her father was left in a coma after being shot in his home during a 1979 burglary. But she reemerged in the late 1980s and 1990s, growing into the role of elder soul stateswoman, said the Detroit Free Press. Though she released just 5 albums from 1998 onward, Franklin had a knack for finding herself at the center of grand moments. Showing her musical range, Franklin wowed the audience at a 1998 Grammys by filling in for ailing Luciano Pavarotti with an impromptu performance of Nessun Dorma. Her performance of My Country Tis of Thee at President Obama's inauguration in 2008 was one of the historic day's most memorable moments. As for her regal nickname, she embraced it to the end. It's an acknowledgement of my art, she said, and I am most appreciative. And we will wind down the show today on the Talking Point page, starting with Warren, A Plan to Reform Capitalism. Elizabeth Warren has a plan to save capitalism, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. While some on the left are flirting with socialism, the Massachusetts Democrat has unveiled a bold proposal that she says will bring back the middle-class wage growth and broad prosperity of the mid-20th century. Her Accountable Capitalism Act would require any company with more than $1 billion in revenue to act in the interest of all stakeholders, not just shareholders. More concretely, workers would be allowed to elect 40% of the company's board of directors, discouraging boards from pushing most of the profits back to investors and executives in the form of share buybacks and other gimmicks. When companies succeed, workers would get good raises. Her plan would redistribute trillions of dollars from the rich executives and shareholders to the middle class without costing a dime. Sounds like pure socialism to me, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Warren's plan would nationalize every major business in the country, putting them under the supervision of a newly created Federal Office of United States Corporations. This new agency would enforce the laws dictating board composition, compensation practices, and even political activities. That's utterly bonkers as well as unconstitutional. The left has so much faith in big government, it has learned nothing from the Trump's presidency, said Robert Trzesinski in TheFederalist.com. President Trump has already threatened to punish corporations that anger him. Under Warren's scheme, he could revoke the charters of certain corporations he believes have been peddling fake news. Warren has the right diagnosis but the wrong cure, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. Her oddball proposal sounds European and vaguely socialist even to the American working class. If we want to give workers more power and higher wages, the solution is simple. We need far more of them to belong to the strong unions that predominated in the 1940s and 50s. Warren's bill has no chance of passing right now, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. But the likely 2020 presidential candidate has started a worthy conversation. Today, 80% of the wealth in the stock market is held by only 10% of Americans. The average CEO makes more than 300 times the average worker. A democracy can function only when it benefits all of the people, and currently the majority of people are workers getting left behind. The press. We are not the enemy. I can barely believe it needs to be said, but the free press is not the enemy of the people, said Adrian Walker in the Boston Globe. President Trump repeatedly slanders journalists and scorns the very idea of free speech because he will stop at nothing to silence criticism, no matter how legitimate. Facts are his real enemy. That's why over 350 newspapers have joined the Globe in publishing editorials extolling the need for an independent media in a free society. Trump, of course, says the hashtag Free Press editorial campaign proves the media has it in for him, said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. But who cares? If the press won't band together to defend its constitutionally protected job against a corrupt, incompetent, half-mad paranoid, no one will. What a self-defeating act of journalistic groupthink, said Michael Graham in CBSNews.com. Who's going to be persuaded or impressed by hundreds of newspapers criticizing Trump while patting themselves on the back? The number of Americans professing a great deal of trust in newspapers hasn't cracked 30% since 2006. You can't pin that on Trump's fake news rants, however over-the-top and wrong-headed they may be. Dull, hectoring editorials are not the answer to Trump's demagogic rhetoric, said Shirab Amari in CommentaryMagazine.com. Millions of voters sent a Bulgarian from Queens to the Oval Office, largely because of the media's overt liberalism and contempt for their cherished beliefs and condescension for their way of life. These people were not all diehard Trumpians. If the press wants to start regaining the public's trust, more humility and less venting of anti-conservative animosities would be a good start. I've written my share of Trump criticisms, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. But this coordinated editorial response is sure to backfire. His base tends not to read newspapers in the first place, and an avalanche of editorials singing from the same script is unlikely to move the opinion needle or deter Trump from attacking journalists and news organizations. Meanwhile, Trump gets a gift in the form of circumstantial evidence of a national press cabal that has been convened solely to oppose him. Rather than providing the president with fresh material, perhaps editorial boards could collectively assign themselves a day of editorials on tariffs, global warming, or the endless war in Afghanistan. Surely these issues are as compelling and urgent as press freedom. Couple of short notes here. A record 72,000 Americans died from drug overdoses in 2017, up 10% from the previous year, according to a new data from the Centers for Disease Control. The practice of mixing highly potent opioid fentanyl into street drugs such as heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine is a major factor in the increased death toll. Americans are eating out a lot more, with the annualized three-month gain in sales at dining and drinking establishments rising 25.3% to $61.6 billion. That's the fastest surge since 1992, according to a new Commerce Department report. And we'll finish off with a quote from poet Khalil Gibran, quoted in the Cape May, New Jersey County Herald. He says, "You give but little when you give of your possessions. It is when you give of yourself that you truly give." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Please give us a call, 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.